Welcome to the Not Old Better Show, Smithsonian Associate Series. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang, and this is episode number 202. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series, our guest today on the Not Old Better Show is Stephen Engel. Stephen Engel is a professor of history and director of the History Symposium series at Florida Atlantic University. Stephen Engel is an expert on the South, the region, the historical tension, the politics, all to help us understand the South's past and present.
Flannery O'Connor said the South was plagued by a historical hangover and well-publicized sins. What a brilliant metaphor to describe the region and the historical tension that exists in attempting to understand the idea of the South. And William Faulkner made the observation that for Southerners, the past is not dead, it's not even past. His work, of course, explored the underlying humanity of the South, often buried under discrimination and intolerance. And it reminds us of the old Soviet joke that the future is certain, it's the past that's unpredictable.
That, of course, is our guest today, Stephen Engel, who will be at the Smithsonian Associates presenting a full program, The South, Exploring an American Idea, Saturday, April 28th, 2018. Please join me in welcoming to the Not Old Better Show via Skype, Professor Stephen Engel. Stephen Engel, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Certainly glad to be talking about this subject. Tell us a little bit about the subject of your upcoming Smithsonian Associates presentation.
Well, we're going to be exploring the American South as an idea, which is really something I've been looking at for a long time. The relationship between people and place and how that creates an identity, a culture out of a region, and a kind of nationalism that morphs itself into a lost cause mentality after the American Civil War, and then into a new era that the South basically endures the modernization and progress of the rest of the nation, sort of the opening up or the Americanization of the South in the post-war era. So in essence, it's going to be, you know, four lectures with four different themes that really culminate in folks, I hope, coming away with an understanding of the idea of the South and what that means going forward as they, you know, see imagery and you know, everything that sort of is in front of our society today. Maybe it gives them a better understanding or perhaps a more insightful appreciation for what the idea of the South means as they interpret the changing cultural landscape today.
I just think this is such a fascinating subject. The South is such an important part of our history. I've read that we may not know where the American South is anymore, but we know we're in it. And so whether it's a region of the United States, the people, the culture, the Civil War, it's certainly an influence on the country. Why is it that we're so fascinated by the South?
Well, I think we've always been fascinated with the South, and I think at least in my generation and in probably the two or three generations before us, largely because of the American Civil War. And you know, to win a war is to be free to move on; to be conquered is to live with the consequences forever. So it's kind of an understanding and recognition that, you know, what the South represented in the American Civil War, people remained fascinated by how that ideology moves forward, and yet another ideology that moves forward that sort of makes the South an unflattering period, an unflattering people, and an unflattering culture that tries to create harmony between democracy and slavery. And why that still fascinates people. And I think because, you know, the South, like much of the nation, is still a work in progress. It's constantly changing. But I think there is this unique past for the South that makes it sort of rather attractive for people to, you know, enhance their education of the region or its history, and allows for, you know, I think, teachable moments in much of what we do in American history. So it presents a kind of case study in culture, in politics, in race and region, and how that can serve to educate us today. So it's still a fascinating region that continues to define us, as most of the culture outside of the South does as well. But the unique thing about the South is it has a fascinating past that you know, we can use as teachable case studies for students to give them some appreciation about where we've been and where we would like to go and where their, you know, what their place is in shaping the future.
You mentioned just a moment ago that the South is both a place and an idea. So in that kind of keeping with that thought, that context, why did the South begin, and what have the effects been on this country as we learn about its history, as we learn about the South's cultural identity?
Yeah, the great question. You know, scholars still debate when the idea of the South began, but we've sort of located it in the early 19th century when slavery began to flourish, plantation life began to dwarf all other life financially, economically in the South in terms of shaping you know, the politics of the region and the racial codes. And yet we see this evolve in a free and democratic society, that this form of human bondage grows deeper into the sort of cultural DNA of people who don't own slaves, have nothing to do with it. And they see this as the sort of social order of the day that sort of transforms and defines their place in the Southern economy and in the social sphere. We know that the South becomes more of an identity the closer we get to the American Civil War, and the closer we get to the politics of expansion, the politics of slavery's role in that expansion, and how the Republican Party is born, you know, out of this free soil ideology that, you know, the real transformation in the economy and the marketplace is for Americans to begin to embrace the, you know, the modern way of wage earning, industrializing, mechanizing. And that begins to erode the sort of agrarian ideals that have been rooted in much of the culture of the South. So there's this sort of outside threat that there's a new political party that is going to somehow undermine these agrarian ways if it gets in power. And so the South then becomes more, I think, more crystallized in an idea as not just a region, but an idea that can transcend the sort of regional identities that, you know, dot the landscape. And so by the time you get to the American Civil War, what you have is, certainly not all Southerners think alike, but at least you have, you know, a sense that there is a movement to secede from the United States, create an independent nation, live the way they want to live. And, you know, for them, the tragedy is that, you know, they do secede, and that, you know, Southern nationalism and Confederate nationalism don't seem to be the same things. And by the end of the war, they find themselves as conquered. And therefore, there is an identity in being conquered that, you know, that is associated with what they once stood for. And that will then, of course, morph into holding on to a past where they can cast themselves more flatteringly into the rest of American history, so it doesn't look like, you know, they, you know, suffered the humiliation. Somehow they were noble patriots carrying out a dream that they believed to be more virtuous than the wealth-worshipping wage earners of the North. So I think it's central to the sort of politics of the mid-19th century that we get this, you know, identification with the South as an idea. And then as we move through Reconstruction, we see that that identification reasserts itself in a sort of a racial hierarchy, and that, you know, while slavery is removed, a color line is put in place that really hardens the views that help to, you know, provide a recognition that what the Confederates fought for in the American Civil War was not in vain, that there was some nobility in fighting for a cause they actually believed in. But in defeat, they have to find a way to form a victory, and they do that in some ways in the Lost Cause, in the memorialization of the war, and in establishing a sort of a cultural connection to the past. They sort of fear moving forward and embracing the changes that the rest of the world or the rest of society in the North is beginning to embrace. And they see themselves looking backwards while sort of like walking backwards, looking into a past that, you know, they can hold on to that doesn't erase everything they once stood for. So it's in that period that I think we really find the roots of an idea for what it means to be, you know, the South.
Fascinating. Again, we are with Stephen Engle. Stephen Engle is a professor of history and director of the History Symposium Series at Florida Atlantic University. Stephen Engle will be at the Smithsonian Associates Program presenting The South, Exploring an American Idea. It's an all-day program, Saturday, April 28th. We're so grateful for your being here, Stephen Engle. I just have a couple more questions because I know we know you're very busy. So let's talk a little bit about the history of the South as this, you know, we all know it to have been a major rural agricultural and plantation culture with its very own political identity. But today, as you refer to, the South is much more diversified, much more urban, much more industrial. What should we understand about the tradition of the South in order to understand the new South and this Americanization that you refer to of Dixie today?
Yeah, another great question, Paul. It's something that I think is not unique to Americans. I don't think, and my sense is that, you know, Southern Americans are not any more unique than New Englanders or, you know, Pacific Coast Americans. I think they just have established their heart and soul in the fabric of American society and democracy at different points in which the evolution of the democratic process was changing. And I think for many Southerners, they find themselves with a long history of having been on the wrong side or the outside of, you know, victory, or the wrong side of the moralist attempts to, you know, create equality. And interestingly, I think what the Civil War did for the North, and I think accelerating reform movements and modernizing the economy and beginning the incorporations of America, I think in the same way World War II, to some degree World War I, but more so World War II, does for the American South. It opens it up for investment, for opportunity. People begin to see the landscape as something more desirable, less distinctive perhaps, but more desirable. And then I think one of the traditions of the South is, you know, there's a uniqueness to the way they do things, to the way they perhaps, you know, cook food and enjoy music and they enjoy the landscape, or perhaps they have different ways of speaking. Not that they would be any different from people in northern Indiana or, you know, Massachusetts, but they're different in their dialects. And I think that's a fascination with Americans who, you know, after World War II began to move into the South. So much of the South after World War II becomes the other American who moves into a region that they now have to bridge the gap between what they know to be South in their history and what they've come to believe by living among Southerners, whether it's in Florida, Alabama, Oklahoma, Arizona, because the South begins to expand its geographic region. And therefore, the traditions of the South are at risk of being overwhelmed by all this fundamental change that looks and acts like, you know, America, you know, put on a coat and tie and went to the city, and therefore Atlanta becomes the sort of, you know, southern Chicago, or Chicago is the northern Atlanta. They're just hub cities that have great diverse cultures. And yet there's this risk that you might lose some of the heritage of holding on to what, you know, Southerners believed made them distinct. Whether they want to hold on to, you know, a history that they thought was unique, that belonged only to them and not to the outsiders who've come in. I think that presents a fascinating tradition for Southerners, that there's this sense of, you know, we can embrace the future to some degree, but we don't want to forget where we, you know, where our roots are, because those roots make us rather distinct and people write about us. In fact, I don't know of an American history course in all of academia across the U.S., that's focused on the American North. But I know across American campuses, there are thousands of courses on the American South, the American West. So, you know, I think Southerners take pride in a uniqueness that makes them worthy of study, whether it's an unflattering, humiliated, you know, portrait, or one that they feel is wrongly asserted by teachers, scholars, and writers. But I think there's this continued wanting to hold on to something they believe is uniquely, and I believe also regionally, rooted in the distinctive regions of, you know, the place they call the South. And so even as the South becomes more urbane, more diverse, more urban, And the history is changing. I mean, because people are, you know, beginning, the history will always change. The landscape beneath our feet is going to always change because people are finding new things to research and write about. So I think the South wants to make sure that there's a portion of their history that, you know, goes along with the narrative of, you know, America is a work in progress. There was this period that was fairly conflicted. Here was the Southern role in it. And we just wanted to make sure that that goes along, whether people take a positive view or negative view of it, that there was a unique past for many of those people living in the South. And of course, I could be making the same case for people who went to war for the Union, that that was the same unique experience for them. So, you know, I just think there's always this quest to understand. You know, so much still is in debate in the in you know, the tensions between, you know, are there still remnants of the old South? Of course, there are always remnants of the old South, not because people are holding on to it, but because there just are. And in fact, people are holding on to the old South in some ways. But there's just a historical nostalgia there that is always going to be present. And this could be said true for any region, but we're talking about the South, and I think it's especially, you know, important in talking about the South.
Stephen Engle, my final question for you. You know, in my research of you and your work, I read about your work examining the American Civil War and the Reconstruction era. And among the dimensions of that period, the politics of power seem to be some of the most fascinating, certainly to our Washington, D.C. audience. And maybe you can touch on, you know, among the many Dixie politicians, who played the biggest role in the South's politics of power? And what was his or her most significant political contribution to the history of the South?
Well, there's so many, but let me sort of conceptualize for the audience a way of thinking about two bookends, people who may not have been as important in their day as the legacy they left behind. Mm-hmm. For example, I would use one person whose legacy sort of characterized for generations what the South as an idea was. And that was Alexander Stevens, who in his cornerstone speech in Savannah in March of 1861 asserted certain fundamental aspects about race that Southerners had come to believe, the certain truths about the biological inferiority and the incapacity of African Americans to become equal because of, you know, some sort of biological deficiency, and that Southerners came to believe this truth and therefore justified the place of the slave in subordination to a master. And that cornerstone speech, regardless of how influential Alexander Stevens was as the vice president of the Confederacy, that speech is among the defining bookends of creating the idea of the South. In other words, it's one of the most often cited points of departure for people wanting to know, well, whatever we may think of the South today, here's what the vice president of the Confederacy wanted you to believe in 1861. So that often gets cited. And so what you find is that he represents an era of, you know, of secessionism, of, you know, racism, of prejudice, of discrimination, of, you know, of Southern nationalism. And who he was during the war is certainly important for the Confederate cause. But placed in the backdrop of that speech, you get a sense for that speech and makes, I think, becomes more important than Alexander Stevens going forward. And then the other person who I think represents the other bookend of this very conflicted period is Blanche K. Bruce. Blanche K. Bruce, you know, is an interesting character because he's born in Farmville, Virginia, and makes his way ultimately to Mississippi. I mean, he tries to make a way in Kansas and in the West, but ultimately comes back to Mississippi, and is in 1874, I believe, the Mississippi State Legislature elects him to be a representative to the U.S. Senate. Now, this is in 1874, you know, an African-American who becomes a U.S. senator. Now, this suggests the agency within the black culture that undoes a lot of our thinking about, you know, the victimization of African-Americans in this period. Clearly, it was a horrific time for African-Americans. But there was this sense of agency, this sense of purpose, and this sense of ownership of advancing the cause. And Blanche K. Bruce, in the same way that Alexander Stevens wants you to believe something about what the Confederacy stood for, Blanche K. Bruce is the example, I think, of the opposite end of that cornerstone speech, and that he, you know, lived and breathed the life of ultimately a freedman of color who rose to the ranks of the U.S. Senate, thereby undermining what, you know, the basis for Alexander Stevens' speech was. And so I think those two taken together, not simply the personalities, but what they represented, are bookends of a very conflicted era that moved very quickly. I think people forget that in the history of the world, what happens in the United States in 1860 and 61 and then in the aftermath during Reconstruction is just unprecedented. The fundamental change that takes place so quickly. I know we think of the war as beginning in 61 and ending in 65, but the reality is Reconstruction begins with the opening of the war as American lives begin to reconstruct and wrap themselves around this catastrophic, titanic conflict that no one, you know, had any sense of what to expect, the size of it, the scale of it, and certainly not what the results would be. And then for Blanche K. Bruce to enter the Senate is a fascinating, I think, commentary on how quickly Americans had the advance. Of course, then this reverses, you know, from decades after that. But at least there is this moment in time where there's this agency. There are these representatives of this agency, and the South, of course, is sort of cast aside in a way that suggests, you know, there are two Souths. There's the White South and the African American South, and that Blanche K. Bruce only represents the African American South, and of course, you know, he's one among, you know, a very handful of those to make it. But I use him as a way of establishing a kind of benchmark that there was this agency, there was this purpose within the African-American community that they could solve the problems if they just move themselves into a position of politics, because change comes at the ballot box. And so I think in the same way that I want to, you know, get the students to understand, or the people coming to the Smithsonian to understand, that this was a very conflicted period, but also a period that saw, you know, legislative constitutional change so quickly, and yet, of course, stalls right after Reconstruction. And then we have this second period of Reconstruction where you're fighting for this agency and you're fighting for this, you know, this ebb and flow of political life to come back. It takes, you know, decades, not until the 50s and 60s. But at least, you know, Blanche K. Bruce and I think Stevens represent the Civil War and Reconstruction era bookends of what was possible, what Southerners thought was possible in leaving the Union, and what African Americans thought was possible in preserving the Union and moving forward in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
Stephen Engle, thank you for that answer. What a wonderful, complete answer to that question. And what great insights, these two bookends, Blanche K. Bruce and Alexander Stevens. Thank you again for that. We're going to learn about that and much more when you are at the Smithsonian Associates Program on the 28th of April. But thank you so much for your time. It's just been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you so much, Paul, and I'm happy to do it. And I look forward to being at the Smithsonian on the 28th.
We look forward to seeing you. Thank you again, Stephen Engle.
Thank you.
My thanks to our guest today, Stephen Engle, who will be at the Smithsonian Associates presenting a full-day program, The South, Exploring an American Idea, Saturday, April 28th, 2018. My thanks as well to the Smithsonian team for all they do to support our interviews. As usual, we will post links to everything, and also as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me. I'm always interested in feedback, and you can leave that at iTunes, Google Play, or send me email at info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about better, the Not Old Better Show. Thanks, everybody, and please remember to check out genealogybank.com/NOBS for great genealogy newspaper articles, history, and data, and to support the show. That's genealogybank.com/NOBS. Thank you.